and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, protests across the Middle East and the world have erupted in outrage at Donald Trump's announcement yesterday that the United States was recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Next, protesters are demonstrating against the Federal Communications Commission's proposed repeal of net neutrality rules at hundreds of Verizon stores around the country beginning today. Why Verizon? Because FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is the company's former general counsel, and it would benefit handsomely from the proposed changes. Then, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is visiting the Greek capital of Athens today, the first sitting Turkish leader to do so in 65 years. Will relations between the two countries that have found themselves on the brink of war three times in the last two decades improve, or will Erdogan's call to redraw current borders nullify any chance of better relations? And then, a government shutdown is looming on Capitol Hill as House Speaker Paul Ryan works to negotiate a deal with Tea Party Republicans. The Republicans appear to have cut Democrats out of the process entirely. Where does that leave Dreamers, healthcare, and other issues important to so many Americans? And finally, Democratic Senator Al Franken announced his resignation on the floor of the Senate today, just one day after a sixth woman came forward to say that Franken had sexually harassed her. Does this portend an attitudinal change on Capitol Hill, at least among Democrats? Or will the party, like the Republicans, continue to rally around their own accused? That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the Middle East. Protests around the Middle East and the world have erupted in outrage at Donald Trump's announcement yesterday that the United States was recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. We're joined from Amman, Jordan, by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Daoud, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Daoud, so many of us here in the United States, journalists, politicians, so many Americans, complained yesterday after this announcement that just the announcement itself would lead to violence and bloodshed in the region. It seems that that has happened. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, first of all, the announcement was wrong. What Trump did was wrong, regardless if anybody protested or not. I don't think that we should be, against what Trump did because people would be protesting. People protesting because it was wrong and unjust. And it was a reward to an aggressor instead of a punishment to the aggressor. And the anger among many people is that this was a totally irresponsible act. It really will not produce any change. And in the meantime, people will suffer as a result of it. And it blew up the peace process or whatever there was of a peace process anyway. So there's many levels of why people are angry, but certainly the anger itself is not the problem. The problem is with the act itself, which was wrong.
Indeed. And I think that's what John meant, was that legitimate protest against an outrageous decision would invariably lead to more people being wounded or hurt or killed. And it's a consequence of and the responsibility of Donald Trump, because this was a gratuitous act. He didn't need to do this. Israel already has the Palestinian people basically cornered, shut down, living under occupation, living under siege. The widespread opposition is so predictable. Again, this is perhaps one of these gigantic U.S. policy blunders where anyone with a brain in their head would think, hey, this is just a bad idea. But then again, so was the invasion of Iraq. So was the bombing of Libya. I mean, there's so many bad decisions, one after another after another.
And in addition to the bad decision, another part of the problem is everybody was telling the White House that this was a terrible idea. Everybody from both parties. And still, Donald Trump decided to ignore everyone.
In addition to the parties of the U.S., 28 members of the European Union, the biggest ally of the U.S., all of them sent a letter to Trump saying, don't do it. The Arab countries, which especially the moderate Arab countries like Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, which Trump is trying to build his kind of new regional alliance on, also told him, don't do it. King Abdullah came back from Washington very depressed of what's happening in Washington. Against all that, he threw everybody under the bus. For what? What does he get out of this? He pleases, you know, Sheldon Adelson, one man who gave him some money for the elections, and in the results he gives up on the interests of the U.S. I mean, look, do a word count of his speech. He mentioned Israel and Israelis 21 times. And this president who talks about America first mentioned America 4 times. So what's more important, America or Israel? I mean, if you're a president of America, I would think if you're talking about America first, what is the interest of America in making such a blunder? It just is mind-boggling.
I'm looking at the website, The New Arab. I think it's Al Arabiya, really. Daoud, I want to read two paragraphs to you from it, from the opening, the lead, and then ask you to comment. A prominent Iraqi militia has warned Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital makes American troops a target, while the Baghdad government has demanded that the U.S. backtrack on the decision. President Trump defied decades of U.S. policy on Wednesday and recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, jeopardizing Middle East peace efforts and ignoring warnings from Arab leaders and Western allies alike, or stoking more unrest. Quote, we caution against the dangerous repercussions of this decision on the stability of the region and the world, close quote, an Iraqi government statement said. Now, Trump is an ally of the Iraqi government. Talk about how this might impact U.S. troops in Iraq. I mean, do you think it's real that the popular mobilization units, the PMUs or the different militias, might, as a consequence of this gratuitous decision, decide to target American troops?
Well, I mean, read Hanan Ashrawi's op-ed in the New York Times today where she quotes what General Mattis said in 2013. He said, every day we in the war in Iraq were paying a price for the decisions of the U.S. And that's so true. I mean, foreign policy is when you create things, when you say things, when you do things in Washington, that, you know, the waves and reverberation are felt around the world. And certainly wherever there is soldiers, wherever there is Americans, American interests are hurt by this. And the point is, if this was done as part of a genuine peace effort where you're trying to kind of get everybody on board, you would say, okay, you know, we'll take a risk for peace. But you did this to please one man. You did this to please Christian Zionists. You did it to please a very small group of Americans who supported Trump. It doesn't make sense from I hate to say this, but I can't find a single American thinker, strategist who has actually said it makes sense. You know, even the Zionist Americans who support Israel are saying this is stupid. Tom Friedman is saying it's stupid. You know, I mean, when you have people saying that it's such a stupid decision that really actually produces no results, it emboldens the occupiers, it emboldens those who are committing crimes and war crimes in Palestine. It makes no sense.
Daoud, there was talk about another third intifada. I think the leader of Hamas has called for a third intifada. The political situation has changed greatly and less favorably, I would say, for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian political parties since the second intifada. But there are people in the streets. What do you expect?
Well, there are people in the streets and people will be in the streets, and intifadas are not declared by a politician. They are, you know, impulsive decisions by people, and if they decide it's the time to do it, they'll do it, whether it's this time or another time. But the thing that we need to kind of concentrate on is this. If we want to have peace, and everybody's talking about peace in the Middle East, how do we do it? Do we do it violently or do we do it nonviolently? Do we do it through negotiations or do we do it through protests? And everything that Trump is doing is basically pushing people to do things violently, to go against the status quo, to actually create the kind of anger and protest that create the environment that makes protests, violent protests, nonviolent protests, much more happening because people are frustrated and angry.
You know, one of the things that Americans don't understand, too, is why the administration would take an action when there's no apparent upside. You know, no country does things out of the goodness of its heart. A country takes an action because of the action being in its national interests. So what does the United States get out of moving this embassy to Jerusalem?
beats me. You have to, if I have to find the answer in Washington, not in Amman.
Well, that's our problem. There are no answers.
I think, you know, Daoud was making the point that it's just pleasing one man, Sheldon Adelson, who's a, you know, a very, very right-wing supporter of very, very right-wing forces in Israel, who actually are building a movement to basically crush the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine in Islam, to make all parts of Jerusalem Jewish. Very extreme, given the, you know, the history of Jerusalem, an extreme measure. But there's a second person who I think Donald Trump is trying to please, and that person's name is Donald Trump. Donald Trump really enjoys wielding power that people say to him, this is crazy, don't do it. But he enjoys the fact that he can do it. He has this kind of authority now. He used to have that authority just in the Trump organization, where he could act like a little imbecile dictator and everybody had to pretend that he was a good guy because he could fire all of them. He likes firing people. Now he's the dictator and applying the same style of executive leadership, but he's managing the affairs of the U.S. empire. And so as a consequence, he's doing a great deal of harm even to the empire. We have a minute left. I would go ahead.
Well, I mean, as you were saying, the issue here is whether you have to use reverse psychology so that you can do the opposite, or whether you need to find ways to send home to the American people, to the American Congress, that the foreign policy that is being made in the White House is against the interests of American and against Americans. That's the problem that needs to be driven home, that this is not going to help peace. This is not going to help even Israel. And Israelis themselves are divided on this issue, whether the idea of declaring Jerusalem as a capital is something that they're really looking forward to, because it's going to bring a lot of tension, and the city, you know, just cannot take tension day after day. So the point that needs to be done is, if there is a need for a desire for peace, then certainly what happened was the wrong direction for peace.
And we haven't heard any real outcry from the Democrats, I have to say,
no,
John, because
no, very little.
And that's how it goes.
Yes.
Well, I think we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Amman, Jordan, by Daoud Kutab. He is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we will be right back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Protesters are demonstrating against the Federal Communications Commission's proposed repeal of net neutrality rules at hundreds of Verizon stores around the country beginning today. Why Verizon? Because FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is the company's former general counsel, and it would benefit handsomely from the proposed changes. We're joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers and by Kevin Zeese. They are the co-coordinators of Popular Resistance. Popular Resistance is mobilizing for the nationwide protests in favor of net neutrality that begin today. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you for inviting us.
So this is a big deal. This is a nationwide protest, and it had to have been hard to organize. Tell us, how are things going so far?
Well, it's a coalition organized it. Fight for the Future, I'd say, was the lead organization. And there are more than 700 protests happening at Verizon's across the country today. So that's just a number of protests is pretty immense. And, of course, each of those protests, you have a bunch of people. So this is an issue that really people are very motivated by. We've had hundreds of thousands of over 700,000 phone calls into Congress in the last couple months, urging Congress to stop Pai. We've had millions of comments at the FCC. So if the Pai goes through with this and Republicans remain silent, this is one of those victories that they're going to regret, because it's going to motivate a lot of voters to be against them next election.
I think what's really exciting to this about this for me, because, you know, we were part of this fight a couple of years ago to win reclassification of the internet so we would have net neutrality. And what we're seeing now is just a whole nother level of activism. I mean, the coalition that fought back then is back together. It also includes Demand Progress and Free Press and a number of groups. But we're also seeing people who are not with formal groups just taking up the, you know, just getting involved and organizing actions and things. And so the public participation, I think this time is much higher than it was the last time around.
And what kind of, let me stick with Margaret, what kind of reaction and response are you seeing so far from protesters themselves? Are you seeing widespread coverage?
No, we don't typically expect to see widespread, widespread coverage of the protests. But I think that the magnitude this time, I think we will see coverage of this, especially what we're basically in right now is a week until the vote in the hearing, the FCC hearing, when Ajit Pai is expected to bring this for a vote. And I think it also, I guess, is helpful that some members of Congress are starting to come out and criticize this. So that always helps to get the media to pay attention.
Kevin Zeese and Margaret, help us understand, help our audience understand what net neutrality means. Because unless you're part of the movement, and of course, I agree with John, this is a pretty impressive movement if you have protests at the same time. It's 700 Verizon stores. Obviously, a big part of the population does know what's at stake, but I think a big part of the population doesn't know what's at stake. So what is at stake?
Well, right now, when you go on the internet, you can go anywhere you want, and you're not going to be blocked. What's at stake is that can change. The companies that give us cable TV, are the internet, the last step on the internet chain, and they will have the power to essentially make the internet more like cable TV, block you from going to certain stations if you don't have the right plan, pay for more to get the right plan, pay for more to get the right speed on your website, or you get a slow website that people won't come to. And so it moves from a very open internet to a very closed one. It moves from a public utility type form where everybody gets electricity.
You know, Brian, I think that many Americans think that they oppose net neutrality laws because it's an issue of capitalism and the free market. I would posit that they don't understand the issue. I think that if Americans understood, well, let me rephrase that. If some Americans understood that under these new proposed net neutrality repeal regulations, their local cable provider could just not show them Fox News, I think maybe they might change their minds on this.
Yeah, that's the exciting thing, is that this coalition is pretty broad because you have independent media news outlets like ours who understand the threats to our ability to reach people if the telecoms can control, you know, content on the internet. You also have businesses and especially even like tech startups who understand that they rely on the internet in order to be able to start their businesses. And if there's kind of monopoly control of it, it can prevent that. But it also comes down to small local businesses who use the internet to reach their customers. And then you see media justice groups and just a whole range of people who understand that the internet has become an integral part of our lives. Just like we need water coming to our house, we need electricity coming to our house, we need internet coming to our house if we want to apply for access to healthcare or get a job or get information, connect with family members. We need to have the internet. And this allows the telecom companies basically to use the internet even more than they do today to nickel and dime us for every single thing that we want to do on there so that it's really going to be a pay-to-play internet going forward without net neutrality.
What makes that worse is that for most Americans, you don't have a choice. You got one cable company. And so if that cable company is abusing their right, their power on the internet and restricting your access, you have nowhere else to go. You're stuck. And so monopoly control, where the company with the monopoly has the ability to control your access, charge you for your access, control your speed, is just a potential for immense abuse.
That's the voice of Kevin Zeese. We're also talking with Margaret Flowers. They are co-directors of PopularResistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. You can hear this show every day, 4 to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. Also at SputnikNews.com. And you can subscribe to it as a podcast through iTunes. Margaret, you're with PopularResistance.org, both of you are. I'm looking at your website about this issue, And you run a piece, I think it's by Bill Moyers. It's a, 6 things people need to know about net neutrality. I want to read just a couple sentences from what you have up on your website. Again, the author is Bill Moyers. In 2015, Pai, that's Ajit Pai, who was general counsel of Verizon and now the FCC commissioner, he was on the FCC in 2015. He offered a lengthy dissent when an FCC majority passed the agency's historic ruling. In subsequent statements, he claimed the decision was part of an elaborate Obama plan to, quote, regulate the internet. Then Moyers writes, hardly. The 2015 open internet rules aren't internet regulations, but a set of safeguards preventing broadband providers from picking and choosing what online content gets priority and what content gets shunned to a slower lane. I mean, I think that sums it up pretty carefully and quickly and understandably. I want to ask both of you, what's the, in addition to the general problem that internet users may have by being pushed into a slow lane, is there the danger of actual political or racial or cultural or religious discrimination based on giving the big tech companies this kind of power?
I would say absolutely. I mean, we were already seeing companies like Google change their algorithm so that websites like ours at Popular Resistance doesn't come up when people search on it. So when you have the telecom, you know, the internet service providers with the power to both provide you access to the internet and control the content that you see on that, then it allows them to put forward their political agenda, and it removes, I mean, right now, the internet is a platform where people in their communities can, you know, create their own media and show the world what's happening in their communities. We risk the loss of that ability without net neutrality.
Yeah, Kevin Z, same point to you.
Yeah, and in this time period is really important because, you know, we have this whole fake news, you know, stuff going around Russiagate. And the idea is that, you know, you can't trust places that aren't the New York Times or CNN. You know, the New York Times and CNN put out their own version of fake news that get us into wars and such. But websites like ours and a whole slew of independent media outlets actually are very powerful. There's a study done that came out of Harvard in the last couple of weeks that showed that when alternative media begins to put out stories and they are echoing each other, you know, doing it almost a strategic way, although it's not really very strategic, it's just people, you know, reporting on similar stories, it really influences public thinking. It has an impact. And that's now being shown in research. And we suspected that. We know that when we did Occupy and had the web to organize with, it created a much easier virus around the whole country where hundreds of towns created their own occupies. When Black Lives Matter put up images of police violence, it created a whole Black Lives Matter movement because people could see what was going on. When stories about what Israel is doing to Palestinians and show videos about that get out in social media and independent media, it has a big impact that the United States can't just blindly or secretly go along with Israel's apartheid system because the people know the truth. And so this is very threatening, very threatening.
It is. And, you know, this is going to be the cause of change. I apologize that we have to leave it right there. That was Kevin Zeese. He was joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers. Both are in Baltimore, and they are the co-coordinators of Popular Resistance, which is mobilizing nationwide protests in favor of net neutrality. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is visiting the Greek capital of Athens today, the first sitting Turkish leader to do so in 65 years. Will relations between the two countries that have found themselves on the brink of war three times in the last two decades improve, or will Erdogan's call to redraw current borders nullify any chance of better relations? We're joined from Washington by Basil Mosaidis, Executive Director of the American Hellenic Educational Progressive Association. Basil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
So this is a big deal for Greece. This is the first sitting Turkish leader in 65 years to visit Greece. But then at the same time, he comes and says that Greece and Turkey need to renegotiate the tenets of the Treaty of Lausanne, which means a redrawing of borders. Is Erdogan serious about this? Is this going to just scuttle any chance of a productive visit?
Well, I believe that these visits are very productive. Now, having said that, the rhetoric that the Turkish president gives on an annual basis, there's a long list of things that he says that he really doesn't mean. He likes to rattle the sword. This is not the first time that he said that or brought this to the forefront, the renegotiation of the treaty. But I believe in the international community, that treaty is really what defines Greece's borders, and that's that. I think this is just another one of his tit-for-tat kind of presentations that he's done over the years many, many times.
Basil, another one of the important issues I think that's going to be addressed in this visit is the issue of Turkish fighter pilots who essentially defected to Greece the night of the coup attempt against Erdogan. Erdogan wants those pilots returned.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's a possibility?
As of today, I don't think so, no, because I believe Greece is going to protect those individuals. They're worried about the fair trial that they would receive back home in Turkey. So, I mean, I'm not a diplomat. I can't really negotiate how all that's going to unfold. But as of today, I don't foresee that happening. But I'm sure that's one of the objectives that the prime minister has on his checklist. I'm sure he's going over to Greece to develop some type of a laundry list of things that he wants in an effort to get one thing, which would probably be those defectors back over to Turkey.
So what do you think each side, the Greek side and the Turkish side, could declare victory over here? What do the Greeks want out of this visit? And what do you think the Turks would settle for at the end of the day?
Those two are not connected, right? That answer is not connected one to the other. So what do the Greeks want? Well, I suspect, in my opinion, from watching them over the years through many different governments, I think they wanted to show an image of being an international player, being able to talk and sit at the table with individuals in the region that are movers and shakers, in this particular instance, Turkey. But they've been very aggressive in trying to get international visits, both in and outside of Greece, to make Greece visible and viable to the world market. Because, as we know, they've been undergoing tremendous financial strain the last 5-7 years. So they're trying to upgrade their image, if you will, okay, by being an international player. Turkey's agenda, who knows what it is? Who knows what they want at the end? What they say is never what they do. So it's very difficult to measure, you know, what is a successful trip for them. The fact that they're meeting, I think it's a positive step. If I were at the table, I would certainly bring one of the topics that I would bring to the forefront would be the almost daily incursion of military fighter planes or naval ships into Greece's boundaries, which is something that they've done for the longest time. I remember as a child, we were talking about the Turkish airplanes flying over Greek airspace. So this is nothing new for us in the Greek American community.
Indeed, in fact, Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, who leads a left wing government in Greece, told the newspaper Kathimerini yesterday that one of his primary goals is to address this issue of overflight. The Turkish violations of Greek airspace are a matter of practically daily repeats. We see this happen all the time over the Aegean, over Greek islands, over disputed islands, even uninhabited disputed islands. And, you know, you get yourself to a point where things get so dangerous. You know, the Greeks may come to the conclusion one of these days that they're going to have to defend themselves and something terrible is going to happen and somebody's going to be shot down. And then we have a major international incident on our hands.
Well, look, John, the HEPA, as you know, has been aggressively speaking on these violations. Earlier this year, Turkey flew over Greece airspace in one day, 138 times. Now, let's take this out of this kind of business as usual environment over there and bring it over to here. If Cuba 15 years ago were to fly over Florida 138 times in one day, what would our reaction be to that?
Right. It would certainly be military.
Okay. So I admire the Greeks for tempering their reaction to what it is. But at the same time, a NATO ally that egregiously violates this basic border definition, it has to be addressed, and not necessarily just by the Greeks, but by the European Union. I mean, those are the guarantors now, right? The European Union, Greece is part of it. So they need to resolve this situation, and it's constant on the Turkish side. It's not, doesn't happen by accident once. It happens almost on a clock, if not daily, certainly weekly, right?
Right.
So it's not something that somebody can just say, oh, it doesn't matter that you do it. Because in Turkey's case, Turkey's like the big barking dog, right? He barks, and when you give him attention, he barks louder. So, I mean, you can't really just let them get away with it all the time. Because eventually they'll say, well, we flew over here 150 times. I guess this is out of airspace
and
now.
And nobody said anything.
No, right.
Right. You know, you raise an important point, too, and that's the point of the larger European Union. Greece wants Turkey to honor an agreement with the EU to crack down on human smuggling. And this agreement was signed in March of 2016, but nothing has really happened. And Ankara's degenerating relations with Brussels has to be a concern for the entire EU. In the meantime, Greece is facing the brunt of this refugee crisis. And in fact, we've reached kind of a tipping point on a couple of the Greek islands where the country just can't accommodate any more refugees because the Turks open their doors and just let them cross through.
Well, I would say to you that maybe it's not just opening the doors. Maybe there might be some of this might be by design. I mean, I don't know. That's an interesting question for someone to answer, but certainly, this is an issue of grave concern for the Greeks, because from a human compassion standpoint, they want to help people, right? But why should or could or can they bear the brunt of the expense of all of this? I mean, we've read the articles of the fishermen in Lesbos taking all these people. AHEPA was one of the first organizations to visit one of these detainee camps. And John, let me tell you something. Those people in those camps are not all refugees, okay? They're not displaced poor children and women and children. They're flying flags in there. They're on a mission. I don't know, by design or by accident, but this is not a healthy situation for Greece or for Europe. And I don't know what, you know, the end game is. But right now, the way things are, it's not good for anybody.
Yeah, you're right. It's not good for anybody. We've got about 2.5 minutes left, and I want to ask you about another broad geostrategic issue that seems to have come up just in the last few days. Yesterday, Erdogan threatened to break off relations with Israel because the U.S. is moving its embassy to Jerusalem. Over the last few years, Greek relations with Israel and Cypriot relations with Israel have improved dramatically,
mm-hmm.
both politically and economically. Are the Turks, do you think, threatening their own relationship with the Israelis out of economic concerns or anger or fear of being left out of the economic development that we're seeing around Cyprus's natural gas fields?
Well, I thank you for asking that question, John, because, you know, the AHEPA worked very hard back in 2010. We had a conference here in Washington, D.C., right on DuPont Circle near our office. We brought together for the first time in history the Greek ambassador, the Cypriot ambassador, and the Israeli ambassador. That was the first time the three of those people were in a room.
Mm-hmm.
They sat down. We broadcasted on you know, on the internet, but they sat down, they talked, and they got to know each other. And from those humble beginnings, these people started to say, well, maybe we need to sort of talk on a more frequent basis.
Right.
Fast forward to today, the HEPA has gone over with the B'nai B'rith and the Council of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. We're going on our third trip this January to enhance the community's involvement on this relationship. And it's a very important relationship for both Greece and for Cyprus, not just for business, but we share a lot in similarities in our culture and our heritage. And that entire Mediterranean region, we all share, as do Turkish people. We all share the same kind of background, if you will. One of them to be out of the loop vis-a-vis, you know, Turkey and their posture. It doesn't make sense to the region, right? They should all learn how to get along.
They should. And every country is going to be the better for it. I apologize, Basil, that we're out of time. Let that be the last word. We were joined here in Washington by Basil Moseidis, Executive Director of the American Hellenic Educational Progressive Association. You're listening to Loud and Clear, and we will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
A government shutdown is looming on Capitol Hill as House Speaker Paul Ryan works to negotiate a deal with the even more conservative Tea Party members of his own party. The Republicans appear to have cut the Democrats at this point out of the process. Where does that leave the Dreamers, health care, and other issues important to many Americans? John Kiriakou, let me ask you, because you were in the U.S. Senate. You were not a senator, but
no,
you were.
I wish I was a senator, but no.
Just a few more votes, you would have done it, man. But you work for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Yes.
You were there. You know the ins and outs. We thought there might be a government shutdown tomorrow. There might still be a government shutdown. But, of course, it's two different processes. In the House, you need a majority, a simple majority. In the Senate, you need 60 votes.
60 votes.
So the Republicans can't go it alone in the Senate. Can they go it
Correct.
Alone in the House?
Up until yesterday, Brian, I would have said no. Today, I'm going to say yes, I think they can go it alone. I happened to be on Capitol Hill yesterday, and I heard several Republican members of the House saying that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, had been working all day long, had been working feverishly to bring in the Tea Party members of his own party, and that by the end of the day, Ryan believed that he could call a vote on at least a two-week continuing resolution to fund the government for two more weeks without having to negotiate with Democrats. I think that's a dangerous step because it alienates a political party that really ought to be a part of the process. And certainly in the past, the Democrats have had the Republicans as partners on continuing resolutions. But I think that that Ryan believes he can go it alone. As you point out correctly, on the Senate side, the Republicans, Democrats have to work together.
In the Senate, there are 52 Republicans, a lesser number of Democrats. I don't know. Al Franken just resigned.
Right.
Will he be there?
He's resigning. I don't know if it's effective immediately or effective tomorrow.
Well, okay. But
either way.
Al Franken aside, they have to get 8 Democrats to vote
yes.
with them. Can they do that? Will they do that? I mean, it's kind of a high stakes game because if the Democrats don't go ahead and vote, then they will be held responsible by Trump.
And that's the thing. That's the thing. There's a real political cost to allowing the government to close because when the government closes, it's not like the government is saving any money. All those government employees who are furloughed during a closure end up getting back pay once they start working again. So the government doesn't save any money. But in the meantime, if a closure goes more than just a few days, you have to start thinking about who's going to process Social Security checks, for example. Who's going to run America's prisons? Because a lot of prison guards, believe it or not, are considered to be non-essential personnel. And so you really start running into very serious problems right around the end of week one of
and
a closure.
And overseas consulates?
Yeah, all consulates will close for everything except emergency American citizen services. So if you die overseas, you can have your body shipped back, certainly. Or if you're arrested, a consular officer will go and visit you. But otherwise, embassies are going to be closed. Nothing's going to get done. And if you're an American overseas and you need something, or if you're a foreign national and you need a visa to visit the United States, the American embassy is closed to you. And you're just not going to be able to travel.
Right. And so at the end of the day, all of these people, all of these federal workers, hundreds of thousands of them connected in one way or another to the federal government, they don't go to work. Are they paid?
Eventually they're paid. If the government closure is less than 2 weeks, then sure, they're going to be paid on time. If the closure lasts more than 2 weeks, they'll miss a paycheck. But then they'll get that paycheck in the next paycheck after once the government opens again.
So it's not a cost saving to shut down the government.
No, not in any way. It doesn't save any money for anybody.
Okay, so then with all that said, because I want the audience to kind of understand some of the mechanics and dynamics here, if the government, you know, as the government shutdown looms, the Republicans don't want to be held responsible for shutting it down, because then Donald Trump could say, if only the Democrats had voted for a continuing resolution for 2 weeks to keep the budget going, the country, the people of the United States, people overseas who want to come to the United States wouldn't be this terribly inconvenienced. It will play bad for whoever is held responsible for the shutdown. But the Republicans or the Democrats will want something in exchange for their vote. So what do they want?
Well, they want the primary thing that they want is protection for the Dreamers. And they've been fighting for this, you know, since the very beginning of the Trump presidency, when the president came out and said that he wanted to end protections for Dreamers. That's a non-starter in Paul Ryan's Republican House of Representatives.
On the House side, not necessarily on the Senate side.
You're right. Not necessarily on the Senate side. See, and this is part of the bigger problem, is you have the Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate, and it's as though never the two shall meet. There's very little communication between the two sides and even less coordination on these policy issues. So the fight really is in the House. In the Senate, Republicans and Democrats want to work together to make it happen. Another thing too, you know, I've been through four or five of these shutdowns over the last 27 years. And for whatever reason, it is always the Republicans that take the political hit. It's always the Republican Party that the American people point at and say, why did you shut the government down? Don't forget, we're not talking just about Social Security checks in American embassies. All national parks are going to close. All national projects come to a screeching halt. You know, roads aren't going to be built or repaired. Bridges aren't going to be repaired. There's real fallout from this kind of a political decision.
It's a weird form of governance where just to pass a basic budget, you have these high stakes showdowns that could lead to a government shutdown. Let's talk again about the politics of it. The Democrats want to be able to vote with Donald Trump so that they're not held responsible for shutting down the government. So they need to show the Democrats, who the base that hates Donald Trump, of course, that they've gotten something out of it. And that something would be some sort of compromise deal where the 800,000 to what maybe 1 million younger people, some of them are now adults, but they came to the United States as young, undocumented children with their parents. Their parents were never able to correct their status, and so they're still undocumented. And then President Obama, through DACA, a deferred action, said, well, we won't deport them. We'll give them relief. In other words, not citizenship, not even a pathway to citizenship, but they won't be deported. And that allowed these people to kind of come out of the shadows, to get permits, to get licenses, to work. And then Trump, by executive fiat, by executive order, did away with the DREAM Act, the DACA, said it was gone. But he said Congress can fix it. Congress can provide some relief to these 800,000 to 1 million people who have lived in the United States almost their entire life. So the Democrats, if they can claim credit for it by virtue of voting for this 2-week continuing resolution, then they can say back to their base, see, we, the Democrats, helped you. In other words, it's politics. Mm-hmm. So Donald Trump is declaring war against the Democratic leadership right now and insisting that they go ahead and pass a resolution, the continuing resolution, to keep the government going. And he doesn't want to have anything about the Dreamers.
Right.
He doesn't. He says, this is what he called Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and their demands for something like Protection for the Dream Act, or Dreamers. Quote, they want to have illegal immigrants pouring into our country, bringing with them crime, tremendous amounts of crime. We don't want to have that. We want to have a great, beautiful, crime-free country. Again, that's Donald Trump. I mean, it's just, are you joking? But nonetheless, I mean, that's how he's presenting the Democrats' already too weak position, insisting on relief, not for undocumented people in general, not a pathway of citizenship for these millions of people who go to work every day, pay taxes every day, whose kids are in school every day, just for these dreamers, this 800,000 to 1 million. And so Donald Trump is purloining the Democrats with wanting a wave of illegal immigrants bringing crime into our country. I mean, it's so disgusting.
So ridiculous. It reminds me, I mentioned this to you off air, it reminds me of the 1992 campaign when George H.W. Bush said, the Democrats just want to tear this country down. And his wife behind him whispered loudly enough for a microphone to pick up, oh, George, no, they don't. It's the same situation now. That nobody in his right mind believes that anybody, any American, regardless of what political party they ascribe to, wants a wave of illegal immigrants and crime into this country.
But what, it's preposterous. But what Trump is doing with this is creating or adding to that atmosphere of hatred
Absolutely.
And fear of undocumented families, demonizing them, targeting them. And simply, and he said before, let Congress fix the problem with the Dreamers. But now here, again, he reverts to this kind of using the immigrant community, including kids, as a political punching bag. I mean, it's really disgusting.
Despite documentary evidence that the crime rate is lower among people who are here in an undocumented status than it is among American citizens in general.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens tomorrow, whether the government will indeed shut down. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Democratic Senator Al Franken announced his resignation on the floor of the U.S. Senate in Washington today, just one day after a sixth woman had come forward to say that Franken had sexually harassed her. Does this portend an attitudinal change on Capitol Hill, at least among Democrats, or will the party, like the Republicans, continue to rally around their own accused? We're joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She is the editor of LiberationNews.org. Welcome back, Jane.
Thanks for having me, John and Brian.
Thank you for joining us. Al Franken's speech today was, he started to say, well, a bunch of the things that were said aren't true. I don't fully admit it. I'm well aware of the irony that I'm being forced out or I'm resigning. It's not about me. It's about the people of Minnesota. And the irony of him having to leave the Senate is that he mentioned that the president, Donald Trump, had been accused by so many women of carrying out sexual abuse and misconduct. He also did not apologize. Anyway, Jane Cutter, what was your take on it?
Well, I mean, there's so much to go after in what he had to say. But, I mean, if you can't really create layers of badness when it comes to forcing yourself on people sexually who don't want you when you're supposedly a leader of a country. I mean, it's like he stuck his tongue in women's mouths who did not want to kiss him. I think he is now disqualified from any kind of moral high ground. And for him to then point at the president and say, yeah, well, he was worse, doesn't really cut the mustard as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he said, I of all people am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls' campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party, meaning Roy Moore as well.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, it says so much about Franken. He really isn't, he's not coming forward and saying, I'm sorry, I apologize, I was awful. Men are treating women in an awful way. I mean, it was obviously just forced on him because the Democratic Party turned against him. I mean, that's all that's really happened. So why did the Democratic Party, John, why did they turn against him?
You know, I think that there are some elements of the Democratic Party that really do want to take the high road here. And while the resignation of a Democratic senator is a price, it's a high price that the party is going to pay, it's the right thing to do. Now, with that said, the Democratic National Committee did not want to take the high road here. It's the DNC that did not want Franken to resign. It's the DNC that defended Franken. Brian, you and I were talking offline about something that Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said, that the Democrats have to take the high road. Well, this isn't really the high road, is it?
She said we have to hold our people to a higher standard.
A higher standard. That's what it was.
Jane, what does that mean, a higher standard? That means like the rest of the country, you know, you're not supposed to stick your tongue in people's mouths that don't want you to. Yeah, that's a higher standard.
That's somehow the higher standard.
Well, I think I saw something today where a strategist reportedly said to NBC that by taking the moral high ground, quote unquote, the Democratic Party now has a clean slate from which to go after Roy Moore.
No,
so
please.
Even in this context, I think, I mean, yes, of course, I'm sure there are Democrats who would like to see the abusers out for all the right reasons. But at the same time, there's always those people who are looking at how they can take partisan advantage from this situation.
That's right.
And if it's harmful to their partisan agenda to have Al Franken, then he of all people has to go too. It doesn't matter how funny he ever once was or what a quote-unquote great leader of the liberals he was in the Senate. He's got to go because he's thwarting their agenda. He's become a liability, and they're going to kick him out.
Jane's right. I'm looking at a Politico article, John, that says, pushing Franken out after Conyers resigned on Tuesday amid misconduct allegations from several former aides also puts Democrats on firmer political ground on the issue of sexual harassment as the GOP prepares for Moore's potential arrival in the Senate. I mean, in other words, when you get down to it, we have a Me Too movement where all around the country and perhaps all around the world, we're at a pivotal moment where women are coming out. They're being believed instead of demonized and targeted and not believed about the conduct of men who are men in power, especially, or men who have more power. And treating women in such a disgusting and derogatory way and treating women in a criminal way, frankly. I mean, it's crimes. You have that kind of Me Too moment, but the Democrats and the Republicans, it is, I think, maybe, bottom line, pure politics.
I hate to say it, but I think that is the truth. I think that's the case. Look, I worked on Capitol Hill for years, not just on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but years earlier, before I joined the CIA, I worked on the House side. And I saw it with my own eyes. It's like, and it's not just Republicans, it's Democrats too. They're constantly on the prowl. And, you know, we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that this is a problem just for Al Franken and John Conyers and Joe Burton on the House side, a Republican, who sent a video to a woman showing himself, you know, he's pleasuring himself, we'll say. It's not just these three people. This is an endemic problem on Capitol Hill, and it comes with power because powerful men think that they can get away with anything. And now, at least, they're starting to pay a price.
Jane Cutter, there was a major article in the New York Times. It's out today, last night and today, about how Harvey Weinstein spent over a year, trying to stop the story that finally revealed how he was a serial rapist. And the thing that's noteworthy about the article is it shows not just that a few people knew about Harvey Weinstein. I mean, and of course, among the few people were warning Hillary Clinton, who even as of September was still, when all of these things were known, you know, the big revelation came out in October, but friends were telling her, don't hang around with Harvey Weinstein. Don't let him keep organizing fundraisers for you. Don't continue to have him do projects with you because it's going to come back and bite you because everyone knows that Harvey Weinstein's a rapist. But what the article shows, I really hope people read this article, is that there's a huge, long, and big institutional environment which not only knew about Weinstein, but in all ways acted to support Weinstein, help Weinstein, including helping Weinstein procure young women who wanted to be actors. And it was constant, every day almost. So in other words, when the women, the six women or seven women went into court with a racketeering charge, a class action lawsuit yesterday in New York, there is a racketeering. It is like an organized crime.
Well, I think that, I mean, that's what it takes. I mean, so you have to have people working full time to suppress and repress and keep down the truth when it is something that is happening in such a widespread and vast way. You have to have people literally working overtime and utilizing rather severe methods of threatening and squashing down the truth. And that's why the women who've spoken up are so courageous and have been rightfully awarded the breaking, the Person of the Year award for being silence breakers, because this is something literally every single woman has experienced in one form or another in the course of her life. We all have experienced this. And so when we speak up and we're not believed, you know, that, of course, is a huge slap in the face. But to keep this truth silenced takes a massive apparatus of repression.
Jane, do you think that this is going to be a real and lasting change on Capitol Hill? Or do you think that we're going to be seeing more of the same, more accusations, other members of Congress? Do you think we've turned a corner here or not?
Well, I don't think it's over. I mean, I think that two things. One is, I think probably more names will come up as this continues to unfold. I don't think these are the last ones. It's a separate question of, are we as a culture, or even is Congress and the Senate turning a corner? I certainly hope so. I certainly hope that the standards, you know, and really when, especially for Washington, D.C., this first came out, you know, 26 years ago, 1990, 1991 with Anita Hill, you know, that was, and what happened then? People believed her, and Clarence Thomas was still brought on to the Supreme Court.
And of course, that was with the interference and support from the head of the Judiciary Committee at that time, and that would be Joseph Biden. Anita Hill was there. She was testifying. She was ridiculed. She was dragged through the mud. And they had a lot more that could have been brought out that would have prevented Clarence Thomas, who was a conservative Republican, from having taken the Supreme Court. But no, they all formed the old boys club, Democrats and Republicans, to make sure it all happened.
That's right. And so, you know, back then, I remember people saying, maybe we've turned a corner on this issue. No, we were just opening up the conversation, although, I mean, it had, of course, been talked about previously.
We're going to leave it there, Jane. Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She's the editor of liberationnews.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or at 1390 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com, or you can subscribe to iTunes and iTunes Podcast. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.